to be unjust. And we have to decide between several people. Can we imagine a situation where we say, well, okay, we've got three candidates, A, B, and C, for this benefit or whatever responsibility is, whatever the decision is, and the right one to pick is C because he's a child of so-and-so, or he belongs to a certain group. That's the only difference. The only difference between A, B, and C is that C belongs to a certain group by birth, and the others who don't. So they say, well, because he has that parentage, because he's in that line, because he's part of that group, so then we'll give him this benefit or this help. Is that morally appropriate? Or is that vicious? Would you want to say that you try to decide, let's say, who to give a benefit to, ask who needs it the most? Or ask who's worked hardest for it? That's relevant. Who needs it? Who's worked for it? Those are relevant features. But just because he belongs to a certain group, just because he has certain parents and grandparents, that shouldn't be part of the decision who should get what. Can you imagine? I mean, why am I raising this? Because, as some of you know, the Torah has mitzvot that apply only to Jews and not to non-Jews, certain relationships that apply. We'll talk about some of the details. So I'm trying to do a little moral background. Is there any case where we would give favoritism to a person on the basis of who his parents are, who his grandparents are, but for no other reason, just because he has those parents and those grandparents? But not because he's better, not because he needs more, not because he's earned more. Or is that going to be just morally wrong, morally incompetent to make a distinction like that? I think people who are affected by democracy and ideal of equality are going to find this pretty open and shut. Just because he has certain parents? That's the only feature? And because of that alone, I'll give him certain benefits? Treat him special? That just seems to be outrageous. Or doesn't seem to be morally relevant who your parents are. And therefore, people will tell you, it's wrong to have different rules for Jews and for non-Jews. After all, the difference between a Jew and a non-Jew is who his parents are. That's all. That's not a morally relevant difference. So we have a problem, because as I said, we have mitzvot that definitely make distinctions between Jews and non-Jews. Now, I think that we're missing a gigantic chunk of morality, which is just invisible, because we are trained to be blind, blind as bats. This has become invisible. And when I tell it to you, I'm betting I'll get the recognition response. Oh, yes, of course. Let's imagine two people ask me for money for an operation, a life-saving operation. They both need the money. They're both the same age. They're both the same intelligence. They're both have the same moral qualities. They both don't have the resources for the operation. And I have enough to give to one. So the one I give to will live, and the other one's going to die. So, if they have the same age and the same intelligence, the same moral qualities, then the thoughts will be flip a coin, because you have no way to make a moral distinction between the two of them. Now, suppose one of them is my brother. What now? Flip a coin?
No.
Well, but being my brother is just a matter of whose parents they have. That's just a matter of who their parents are. Nothing else. Doesn't make the one better than the other, nicer than the other, morally more deserving than the other. We said parentage is irrelevant. Doesn't count. It's a moral throwaway. But when it comes to family, that's not really true. You have special obligations to your family that you don't have to other people. Certainly to give preference if it's life and death. And other obligations as well. And family is only a matter of parentage. Nothing else. The fact that he's your brother doesn't make him morally more deserving, except from you. He has a bigger claim on you than other people do, because he's your brother. But that's only a matter of who his parents are. I saw a paper in the Journal of Philosophy many years ago. The author said that family is a refutation of every going moral system. Because no moral system can account for the fact that you have special obligations to your family, and it's clear that you do have special obligations to your family. So every moral system runs afoul of this problem. Okay, now let's see what kinds of differences we would allow, intuitively now, before we come to what the Torah says. What kinds of differences would we allow in our relationships to members of our family rather than other people? I think certainly the amount of charity, the amount of support. If you have a brother who's in trouble, a brother whose business is in trouble, or whose health is in trouble, so the amount of support you are expected to give to a sibling is vastly more than the amount of support you're expected to give to a stranger. What about feelings? Let's talk about love. We could discuss whether love is something that can be commanded or can't be commanded, but let's talk about what's expected. Let's talk about what's normal. Let's talk about what's reasonable. I think it's expected and normal and reasonable that people, members of the same family, should love one another. Maybe it doesn't always work out. There are exceptions. But it's expected, normal, and reasonable that members of the same family, especially nuclear family, but even more extended family, first cousins, uncles, aunts, will love one another. Should we expect as normal and reasonable loving your next door neighbor to the same extent? Gosh, you know, if you live in an apartment building, you probably don't know 5% of the people in the building. Go up and down the elevator, you see them every day, you don't know who they are.
That was a
yeshiva. Okay, you got a couple of hundred guys. Could you be expected to love someone whom you don't really know? Love him? Suppose the person is not only someone you don't know very well, but he comes from a different culture. Just speaks a different language. And has a very different outlook on life. He just happens to be living next door to you because he got a job with IBM. But he's from Sri Lanka. He's one of the Tamil Tigers, you know. He believes in blowing up his enemies. Just learning how to do better computers to have better controlled bombs so he can blow up the Sri Lankan army. We have our own local group that has similar ideas. Would it be expected that you should love him? Love requires a certain amount of sharing, a certain amount of identification, a certain amount of connectedness. If the other person is a blank to me, I just don't know who he is, I have no idea what kind of person he is. Or, if I know what he is, I know that he's very different from me. With opposite ideas, opposite ideals, opposite goals. Is it really normal to expect that I should love him? Imagine a philosophy, I don't think you have to imagine too far, imagine a philosophy which says everybody should love everybody. What kind of love would that be? Would there be any degrees of love? Imagine you're fighting a war. You're in Israel, so you don't have to imagine too hard. Imagine fighting a war, and you have your fellow soldiers, and you're sitting in the foxhole, shooting at the enemy, and you will and have missed your lives for the other guys in your group, and they've missed their lives to you. And on the other side, you have people who are trying to shoot at your babies. That's their goal, to kill as many Jewish babies as possible. Now, am I supposed to love my comrade in arms equally with those people who are shooting at my babies? Love them all equally? Is that normal? Is that reasonable? Is that expected? Now let's, so we have degrees. There's your family. There are the people who live in your town, the people who live in your country, the people who share your culture. And the further you get from yourself, the less love is expected, the less love is reasonable. Let's push it to the extreme. Suppose someone draw the principle. The principle is love everyone equally. What would happen? If you had to love everyone equally, what would happen? You'd love everyone as little as the farthest person from you. Everyone's love would drop down to the level of the love you have for the person who's farthest away. That's the only way to make it equal. To demand that I raise my love to the person who's farthest away, it's totally unreasonable. How can I love someone with whom I have no identification? For whom I have no understanding? Or I have deep, abiding misunderstanding? Do I shoot at him out of love? Shoot to kill out of love? I love you so much, I want you dead. That does sound like a travesty. That does not sound serious about love. Family is a principle that has moral consequences. Now, the key to many of the laws that distinguish Jews from non-Jews is that in Jewish thought, in Jewish philosophy, the Jewish people is understood as a family. Our responsibilities to one another are responsibilities of members of the same family to one another. That is why certain preferences are given to Jews that are not given to, that are not extended to non-Jews. And if it's understood as family, then I think the moral basis is clear. I'll give you some examples of how this works. And I don't think there's a complaint. I'm going to give a couple of examples, and I'll stop to take questions. We're not, I'm going to push on. Especially in the Middle Ages, we were very severely criticized for the laws of interest. If a Jew lends money to another Jew, he's not allowed to take interest. Usually there are exceptions and conditions and contracts, but the normal rule is that if you lend money to another Jew, you're not supposed to take interest. If you lend money to a non-Jew, then you can take interest. What happened in medieval Europe was, the church in medieval Europe said, no one can take interest from anyone. So the Christians, who needed capital, who needed investment, where did they go to get loans? They went to Jews. The Jews lent the money for interest. So the Jews were usurers, because usury means interest. And that made us very evil. Of course, they can't even use that anyway, because they needed it. So they went to us and despised us and hated us, even though they used our money. Now let's think. Is charging interest when you lend a person money, is that wrong? Unjust? Vicious? Are you victimizing the other person when you charge interest for lending him your money? Sorry?
It depends on how much interest you
Why? Why does it depend on how much interest you charge?
Certain amounts of interest are unreasonable.
Then, people won't borrow at that level of interest. Someone else will offer money at a lower level of interest, and it'll undercut you, and you won't have anybody taking the loan. Let's make a comparison. A rent-a-car business. Somebody owns a fleet of 100 cars, and he rents them out. Is there anything unjust about renting out your... You own the cars. You own 100 cars. Right? And you're renting them out and taking a fee for renting out the cars. Any unreasonable, unjust, vicious, morally underhanded and duplicitous about renting out cars? I don't think so. Suppose you rent out your house. Go on a trip and you rent out your house. You charge rent. Why? Is there anything wrong with charging rent when somebody uses your house? Okay, if he uses your car, you can charge him. If he uses your house, you can charge him. And if he uses your money, why can't you charge him? He's using something of yours. You didn't have to give it to him. You need an incentive. He says, listen, he's giving you $1,000, I'll pay you $1,100. Okay, for $100, I'll let you use my $1,000. Like I'll let you use my car, and I'll let you use my house. Money is just another commodity. It's another piece of property that I have, and you want to use it, I want to be paid for that. Don't want to pay me, don't use it. As he says, if I charge 20% interest, and there's a market of people that are willing to pay 10, someone else will lend it at 10. If I charge, if my rates for my cars are too high, no one will rent my cars. If my rates for my house is too high, no one will rent my house. See here, no one will rent my money. There is nothing morally vicious in charging interest for the money that you lend. Yeah.
Well, what about nowadays? People conspire so they can set prices. So if I say I'm going to charge 30% interest, I say to Joe charged 30% interest, so then there's no one you can go to who's at like 10% interest.
You know, I'll tell you, we're getting into a matter of detail now, but I think it's a little interesting. I don't want to spend too much time on it, but price fixing, right? What exactly is wrong morally with price fixing? Morally. After all, when you talk about unions, what are unions? Unions that we're all going on strike together. Why? You're organizing labor to strike together. That's okay. But when the corporations organize among themselves to charge a uniform price, that's not okay.
Well, you were just saying that if something's too expensive, then someone's going to charge for less.
Right.
But then the exact opposite is that they're going to be fixing it so that no one can charge less.
Okay. Let's say so.
Two statements.
Good. I wasn't taking that into consideration. You're right. But I'm raising the moral question even at this level. So what's wrong with it? Isn't it permissible for people to talk to one another? Isn't it permissible for people to plan together and cooperate with one another? Why shouldn't they plan and cooperate to fix prices? After all, when labor plans and cooperates to strike all together and therefore bring the company to a close, that's perfectly all right. Because the freedom of labor to work when they want and not work when they don't want, and to organize and do a joint action. So why shouldn't the corporations be able to organize and do a joint action? The answer has nothing to do with morality. It has to do with economics. You stagnate the economy that way. It's not a question of morality. It's either charity or it's stagnating the economy. But in terms of the injustice of it, why is it unjust for people to decide, I want to charge more money for my car?
Well, I think someone does have some morality because if you think about it, when people are striking, like a lot of times they're doing it because they need the money to survive, like to support themselves, whereas when corporations set prices, it's not because the head of the corporation can barely get by and he can't make ends meet because he wants to have like 3 Ferraris or something.
I understand.
Instead of just 2.
Okay. You're right.
You can't really compare the two.
Well, it depends on what the comparison is. If you're talking about the responsibility of charity, I agree with you. But then what you're doing is going to a person with a gun and saying, give me your money for charity. I'm taking it. I'm not asking you whether you like it or not. And that could be questioned on moral grounds as well. But if you're talking about the freedom to do with your property as you please, if I own the corporation and the products are my products, and legally they're mine, it's 15,000 pencils. They're my pencils. You're telling me I can't charge the price I want for my pencils? Why shouldn't I charge the price I want? And if I and my friend next door, he has another 15,000 pencils, and we want to charge the same price? Where is the moral failure here? just that we're not providing pensions for people cheaply enough so that they'll be having enough money to go on vacation. So that's a matter of charity. Now, I'm not cheating anybody. I'm not disadvantaging anybody. I'm not victimizing anybody. They're my pensions, and I'm charging the price that I want to charge for them. This is not... So the point that I'm working for is this, that charging interest for money is no different from charging rent for any other item that you rent out to people, to the public, and there's nothing unjust about it. Even your question is just how much you should charge and how it should be organized what you charge. But I don't think in morality you can force people to compete. If you want charity for the poor, let them fix prices and take off the top 20% for charity. What's it got to do with fixing prices? There's nothing to do with it. All you're doing is saying that this guy wants three Ferraris. Let him have three Ferraris. That's what he wants to spend his money on. He offered a product for sale. If people are willing to buy it, then let him have his three Ferraris. There's nothing wrong with that. Yeah.
What if it's not all interest rates? Like a bank doesn't always offer the same interest rate to everybody. There's discrimination on age usually. So if you're a young person, like when I bought my car, I didn't have a choice. I had to take a 20% interest rate because it's outrageous.
Let me ask you a question. How do they fix those interest rates?
Based on usually on income.
And what difference does it make what income you have or what age you have? Because over time, they have experience that these people pay back and those people default. And when they default, they lose money. And they losing money means it's their shareholders who invested their life savings in the bank, so they'll have a retirement income, and they're losing their money because the bank is giving out bad loans. Right? I mean, it's all based on making the biggest profit possible. All business is based on making the biggest profit possible. That's what a market economy is. That's what a capitalist economy is. You're worried about poor people, tax the top. That's one way to do it that's across the board. But price fixing? Price fixing is just a way of making sure there'll be competition to speed up the rate of improvement of products so because of competition. That's a way of driving the economy. It has nothing to do with morality. It's economic considerations. But at any rate, charging money for what you rent out is not certainly nothing evil about doing that. Why then would there be a law not to take interest from other Jews? If there's nothing evil about it, nothing unjust about it, nothing vicious about it, why then should there be such a law vis-a-vis the other Jews? You see, the assumption is built in, and this is the mistake, is that if we say you can't do it to another Jew, it must be vicious. Ah, but then you can do it to a non-Jew, so you see, therefore we're allowed to be vicious to non-Jews. But that's not true. Logically, it's not true because there's nothing vicious about lending money for interest. But then you have to ask, if there's nothing vicious about it, why would you forbid it vis-a-vis other Jews? And the answer is what I told you. If your brother comes and asks you for a loan, do you charge him interest? I don't know how families are today. Maybe today you go to the lawyer and make it out for, 15% compounded. But you can understand an ideal where people say, for my brother, I'm not going to charge him interest. Ah, you'll ask. If your brother wanted to borrow your car, you wouldn't charge him for that either. And if your brother wanted to buy your house, you wouldn't charge him for that either. That's true if you have a family of 6 or 8 or 10 people. But if you have a whole nation that's being treated as brothers, then you have to provide for the possibility of an economy and also provide for the love between family members. See, here's how you do it. If your brother is in need, you lend him money at no interest. With the money at no interest, he can rent a car, he can rent a house, and he can buy food, and he can buy all the other things he needs. Where you do charge. So that's where you are able to provide for your brother and also able to run an economy. So here the rule not to charge interest from other Jews is going above and beyond what is appropriate as far as justice is concerned. This is more an expression of love. And the love that should be a present among family members, and which it is absurd to require, should apply beyond the family. The same is true with love itself. You're supposed to love your fellow Jew as yourself. But that's because your fellow Jew shares with you an enormous amount of his identity. And if, by the way, you're talking about a Jew who doesn't shear, then there is a question whether the mitzvah of loving him applies. But let's see how far it goes. To what kind of Jews must this love apply? How far does it go? Let's imagine a Jew who has committed a capital crime. He's committed a crime for which there is capital punishment. Do I have a mitzvah to love such a Jew as well? Anybody know the answer?
Why not?
Why yes? You can't guess at this. Is he called Re'acha? Sometimes they say Re'acha b'mitzvahs, right? The answer is yes. And the form of capital punishment is designed to be as painless as possible because the Gemara says you have to love him. And if you have to love him, you have to do it in such a way that will minimize the trauma to him. So even though he's a criminal, has committed a terrible, terrible crime, still loving him applies. Why? I mean, why? The Torah says it directly. I need more of a justification. But the explanation in terms of philosophy would be, we share so much. We share, you know, if you had a brother who, God forbid, went off, became a criminal, and you visit him in prison, would you stop loving him? You'd feel terrible that your brother's life was shattered in this way, even if he did it, and he did it, chose it. Still, it's your brother. So there's that attitude that we come from the same source. And we do share, even with his deterioration, even with his crime, we do share the same basic picture of the world. Only, he did not act in a civilized way, in a reasonable way. Or he did act in a criminal and vicious way. But that doesn't change who he is. Whereas somebody who's outside the family, you won't have the same feelings for them, and it's not even appropriate to have the same feelings for them, because you don't share as much. You haven't got the same kind of shared identity and shared life that you have with a family member. So, if someone asks, do we treat Jews and non-Jews, by the way, what I'm telling you now comes from Rashi Tovarish. He's the one from whom I learned this general idea. He said, we have a two-tiered system. All people must be treated with justice. All people must be treated with justice, Jew or non-Jew. But in addition to that, other Jews have to be treated with love. That's not required in the way you treat other people. You might love a non-Jew. That might happen. Nothing wrong with it. I'm not talking about getting married. I'm not talking about love between members of men and women. I'm talking about human love. Yudha Nasi and Antoninus, the Roman emperor, had a very close relationship. And when Antoninus died, Rebbe was devastated emotionally, and Rashi says because he loved him. The Jew went alone. It definitely can happen, and when it does happen, it certainly could be appropriate. But it's not required. It's not required. It would be quite unreasonable to require it. Questions up to here? Okay, now, when we live in a mixed community, then we have another factor that must be taken into account, and that is sanctifying God's name, or God's really the opposite of desecrating God's name. Jews bear God's presence in the world, God's identity in the world. What a Jew does, people look at and say, that's what their Torah stands for, that's what their God stands for. And since the so-called Jewish God is the only God, the one God, the creator of the universe, so if people look at Jews and they feel that Jews are morally derelict, morally inappropriate, then it creates a desecration of God's name. And we have a responsibility not to let that happen. And this means when we interact with other Jews or with non-Jews, makes no difference. The interactions have to be such that will redound to our credit, and through our credit, the credit of the Torah that we represent. And this applies to all of our everyday behavior. I don't know how many of you come from Brooklyn. But, okay. And if you don't come from Brooklyn, you can come from Beit Sharim and from Geula. Double parking. A thing as simple as double parking. Or cutting your head in line. Or not being willing to help someone in need. Something as simple as that can make the difference between admiration, respect, and honor versus degradation. And of course, if you wear a yarmulke, so then the person looks at you, and in you he sees the whole Jewish people. He will generalize immediately. That is, if you do something bad. If you do something good, you might very well say you're only an exception. That's the way anti-Semites think. Yeah, if you do something good, he's an exception. If you do something bad, he's typical. But if you do something bad, then you definitely reinforce that prejudice. And we have no right to reinforce such a prejudice. So, we have to look at the non-Jewish world as, so to speak, our field of endeavor. The prophet Isaiah, Isaiah says we should be Or LaGoyim, a light to the nations. And here's the background, the historical background. God spoke to Adam and gave him a mitzvah, maybe a whole set of mitzvahs. Adam and Chava were it. They were everybody. There was no discrimination, this group and not that group. They failed. So, the world began to grow. They all had a tradition from Adam and Chava, what God had said to them, and how the world is made, and what the world is for. And they all deteriorated. They came to the flood. So the flood wiped everyone out except Noah and his family, and God started over again with all of them. No discrimination, no distinctions. God spoke to Noah and all three of his sons. And gave them rules and gave them a tradition. And they handed it down to their children, their grandchildren, the great-grandchildren. And then the world started to deteriorate and disintegrate. Came to the Tower of Babel. Rebellion, an organized rebellion against God altogether. Only Abraham took, he discovered for himself, in some sense, some parts of the message. God inspired him with the rest of the message. His family and those whom he converted, the people whom he influenced, discussed with, persuaded, formed a new group. But anybody could join. It was open for anybody to join. Then the Torah was given at Sinai. The Midrash says, and the commentators think this literally, that God offered the Torah to every human nation. Every human nation had an opportunity. This is the third or fourth time, depending on how you count, that God is trying to reach everyone simultaneously, with no distinctions, no bars, no gates. Everyone could have come to Sinai and joined us. Everybody said no. So after three or four shots, trying it with everybody, God moved to a different strategy. The strategy is to have a permanent, absolute relationship with one group, still leaving the door open for anybody else to join. The door is still open. Anybody who wants to convert can convert. Whole nations want to convert, they can convert en masse. It can certainly be arranged. So here, the discrimination, if you like, or the distinction, if you like, is only halfway. There's a certain group that's definitely in, but no one is excluded. No one's excluded. So I think what we have to see from history is that the distinction between Jews and non-Jews is to a certain extent an artificial distinction. It was not the first plan, it wasn't the second plan, it wasn't the third plan. And as the fourth plan is not absolute anyway, because others can join even now. So that if there is a continuing distinction between Jews and non-Jews, it's because non-Jews have chosen to remain non-Jews. It's their choice that they've exercised. Not because the Torah imposes it on the world. Indeed, if you look at this from the eyes of the contemporary West, which eyes I would encourage you to start shedding rapidly, but if you do, you might even see a certain advantage to the non-Jewish side. Because a Jew who's born a Jew remains a Jew no matter what. There's no way for a born Jew to escape it. The present Archbishop of Paris, the Catholic Archbishop of Paris, is Jewish. He was a boy who was hidden during the Holocaust, hidden with a Catholic family. After the war, I don't know whether his parents were killed and he never came back, or whatever. And he was raised by Catholics in Poland. And he became Archbishop of Paris, even though he's Jewish. He's a practicing Catholic Archbishop who's Jewish. And from the point of view of the Torah, there's nothing he can do to escape being Jewish. He has no choice. Whereas a non-Jew has a choice. He can remain a non-Jew if he so desires, or he can become Jewish if he so desires. Now, a system which says Group A is identified without asking them and is forced into a certain position without a choice, and Group B has a choice to join or not to join, I think for many people, Group B would be in the preferable position. The more choices you have, the more freedom you have, the better off you are, some people think. So, from the point of view of the external observer, the external critic, I think it's going to be hard to make a case that the difference between Jews and non-Jews is discriminatory in a vicious sense, when the only difference that a non-Jew has is that he can choose whether he wants to be Jewish or not, whereas a born Jew doesn't have that choice.
Isn't there a severe penalty for idol worship if he becomes Christian, Catholic, whatever?
I didn't say that he could worship idols. I said it didn't have to be Jewish.
Mm-hmm.
There's another alternative, right? There's what they're called B'nai Noach. All over the world now, there's a worldwide movement of people who have discovered that the Torah is true and have also discovered that the Torah does not require them to convert to Judaism. And they are prepared to live up to the Jewish rules for non-Jews. They even have a website. You can look them up, B'nai Noach. In fact, about 9 years ago, in a church in Tennessee, in the United States, the minister and half of the congregation came to the conclusion that Christianity is not true, and Judaism is, and they wanted to take down the cross to remodel the church, and the others didn't like it. And they started a movement, and they came to Israel for several weeks, and they had consultations with the chief rabbis. What does the Torah say about non-Jews? What rules do they have to live by? There are books on it. It was about 8-9 years ago. And then they set up a website. They have this worldwide educational effort and movement. Now, so that's their prerogative. They can do that if they like. That doesn't include idol worship. It means living according to the Jewish laws for non-Jews who don't want to become Jewish. So it's hard to see that as a disadvantage. Again, people are worried about elitism, and they're worried about setting up classes. They want a classless society. They don't want classes in society. They'll make analogies with the nobles of old, where you were born into a class of nobility and they gave you special privileges. What was really vicious about that is that if you were born outside the class, you couldn't get in. But imagine a class of nobility which has special privileges, special position, special status, and anybody who wants to join can join. But that's sort of like a museum or a football club or a political party. Anything vicious about that? Yeah, you have to pay dues. Well, most organizations that are providing a service or providing some kind of function, you have to pay dues. If you pay the dues, you want to join, you can join. So not everybody's a member, but the people who aren't members because they chose not to be members. I can't see anything to complain about here. So setting up a world in which there's a difference between Jews and non-Jews, I don't think can be regarded as a kind of vicious discrimination, because it's a matter of one's own choices to what one wants to achieve or what one wants to accomplish. Okay, one last thought. Non-Jews are required by the Torah to live up to about 65 commandments. I know some of you have heard about the 7 laws of the children of Noah. So it's a mistake. It's 7 categories of laws. But if you compare their responsibilities against our 613, it comes out to be about 65. What happens if a non-Jew says, these 65 laws are not enough for me to express my spirituality? There's not enough here for me to grow and develop myself spiritually. A non-Jew can perform almost every commandment of the Torah voluntarily. And he will get reward for it. He can volunteer for it. And the Gemara has many such examples. For example, honoring parents. Honoring parents is not required for non-Jews. But if he wants to, he can do that. Keeping kosher. He can keep kosher. And he'll get credit and reward for keeping kosher. There's nothing specifically Jewish about keeping kosher. A Jew has to keep kosher. But if a non-Jew wants to keep kosher, he definitely will get a reward for that. Most of the laws of the holidays. Laws of speech. Charity. Not taking interest. All these laws, if he does them, he'll get credit for. Yeah.
I heard once that you're not allowed to like, teach Torah about non-Jews because it's like giving away your heritage.
So the answer is this. The Gemara says that a non-Jew who studies Torah can be greater than the high priest.
Yeah, where is that? Okay.
Greater than the high priest. No, so how could it be that you can't teach him Torah? How do you learn Torah? So the Gemara asks this question. The Gemara says he is allowed to study and really should study those parts of Torah that apply to the mitzvahs that he's keeping.
What's the other part? What about the other part?
Not the other part. But now if he volunteers to keep all these extra mitzvahs, then all that extra Torah is something that he should learn. Otherwise he won't know what to do. So the first level is the 65. That's the ground level. That's required of everyone. After that comes the volunteering for whatever mitzvahs. The only example the Rambam says is Shabbos. Non-Jews not allowed to keep Shabbos. Maybe there are a couple of others, but the vast majority, sacrifices he can bring, there's all sorts of things that he can do. And then, if that's not enough, if all those voluntary mitzvahs are not enough, then he can convert to become Jewish. So he really has three options. The second option is very fluid, because he can choose whatever mitzvahs he wants to do, and be rewarded for it. So he has a tremendous freedom of operation. Which a born Jew doesn't have. Yeah.
Why can't they keep Shabbos?
Well, there's a verse in the Torah which says, after the flood, God says that the world is going to run on a regular basis without any cessation. And it says, summer and winter, and cold and heat, and it says, planting and plowing and reaping, it's going to be a ceaseless cycle. From which we learned that a non-Jew is not allowed to keep Shabbos. Now, the question is exactly what Shabbos do we mean? Saturdays only, or during the rest of the week, 24 hours, sunset to sunset, or sunrise to sunrise. There are all sorts of discussions about the details. But the idea is that they're not supposed to have that kind of structure to their time. Whereas a Jew is responsible to keep Shabbos. But all the other ones, blowing a shofar in Rosh Hashanah, because that's the day of creation of the whole world, blowing a shofar is a way to recognize that. The non-Jew will do that, we'll get credit for it. Right, so there's a tremendous flexibility. A tremendous flexibility for a non-Jew. And then the final step if he wants to become a Jew. Yeah.
What if the non-Jew says, I want to have Malacha, but no Avodah?
I don't know. It's a good question. So it's a question of fine detail, and I don't know the answer to that question. There are books upstairs in the library about responsibilities of non-Jews according to the Torah, and there are several good books on the subject in English, so you can look it up. Maybe one last thought, and I could go teach in the other building. The Torah says that man was created b'tzelem Elokim. Now, your English translation usually says in God's image. As you all know, that can't be right. God doesn't have an image. There's no picture of God. Tselem in Hebrew does not mean image. Tselem means some essential characteristics. We share, or better, we have essential characteristics analogous to some of God's essential characteristics, whatever that means, ultimately. Now, that's true for all people. That's true for all people. The Mishnah says, happiest man, greatest man that he's created in God's form, and even greater is it that God told him that he's created in that form. So everyone bears that divine stamp. That doesn't mean there aren't differences. There are differences within the divine stamp, but the divine stamp itself is something that's shared by everyone. when the Jews crossed the Red Sea and the Egyptians charged after them, the seas crashed down on the Egyptians, drowning them. There's a famous midrash that the angels wanted to sing God's praises, and God silenced them with the words, "The works of my hands are drowning in the sea, and you want to sing my praises? The work of my hands, Maaseh Yadai, is the Egyptians." In other words, the salvation of the Jews cost. It cost the lives of the Egyptians. And God says, for me, that's a loss. For me, that's a loss. Because they're my people. And therefore, this incident is not totally positive. It has a downside. And your singing will not register the downside. And you have to register the downside. And we, the Jewish people, in later times, also registered the downside. Some of you know, at the Seder, at the Passover Seder, when it comes to the 10 plagues, we take a drop of wine out of the cup for each of the plagues. Why? Because if our salvation meant that they had to suffer, then we have to reduce our celebration. Because there's a loss in it to God, and a loss in it to God is a loss for us also, because we're supposed to represent God. Yeah.
It was either us or Canada. So, if we stayed in Egypt and we put it all stuck in more and until there was no way out.
Right.
Or it's by us coming out and them all being wiped out. So if those are the only two options, then this was the best option that could have happened.
Yeah, but that's not the issue. You're confusing two issues. One issue is, of two options, which is better? And the other is the better option all good? Those are not the same question. They don't get the same answer. Let's take a person who has gangrene in his foot. Gangrene. Gangrene is a disease which, if it spreads to the rest of the body, kills a person. For sure. Okay? And there's no way to cure it. Once it takes hold in a limb, there's no way to cure it. The only thing you can do is amputate. So now you got two choices. Cut off his foot or he dies. What's the better choice? Cut off his foot. But you don't celebrate the lost foot. The guy now lost foot. So that's bad. Only, of the two options, this is the better option.
The body, though, is happy that it wasn't affected by it.
Well, let's suppose the rest of the body has to eat. And the only available food is rabbits running through the underbrush. And it needs to catch one. And missing the foot, it can't catch one. The rest of the body is going to be very sorry it doesn't have another foot.
But the Egyptians were evil, though.
The foot is full of gangrene. I have to cut it off. I'm happy I'm alive, but I'm not happy I lost a foot. Just that one happened to cost the other. The person doesn't volunteer for gangrene. Even though he can be cured by cutting off the foot. He don't volunteer for it. The fact that A is better than B doesn't mean that A is all good. You're confusing those two issues. Right? It had to happen that the Egyptians would be killed. And it was better that way than the alternative, but there's a cost. And that's what has to be registered, that there was a cost.
You mean also that when Hitler died, God was dead also?
It could mean that, although it doesn't have to apply to every case.
I was just going to ask something along the lines. If you're a boy who's a Rasha, you're a wicked people, so God still takes sorrow on your back? I thought like he rejoices when the wicked die.
If a person has gangrene in his foot, and they cut off his foot, will he be happy or sad?
He's not going to be happy.
He saved his life! You know, you pay a surgeon to do this, and you are very grateful afterwards, you shake his hand and say, thank you very much, even though you lost a foot. On balance, it can be something which you're happy about. That doesn't mean there's no downside. There can be a downside, and on balance, you can still be happy. Right? Things are not black and white. There's a little bit of gray. Okay.